after someone else, and now there's nobody left who even needs me." Her eyes brimmed with tears. I thought for one terrifying minute that she was about to howl. "We'll always need you, Mum. I don't know what I'd do if you weren't here. It's like you're the foundations of a building. I might not see you all the time, but I know you're there, supporting me. All of us. I bet you Trina would say the same." She looked at me, her eyes troubled as if she weren't sure what to believe. "You are, and this is a weird time. It's going to take a while to adjust, but remember what happened when you started your night classes? How excited you felt, like you were discovering bits of yourself. Well, that's going to happen again. It's not about who needs you. It's about finally devoting some time to you."
"Josie," said Dad softly,
"we'll travel. We'll do all the things we thought we couldn't do because it would have meant leaving him. Maybe we'll come and see you, Lou. A trip to New York. See, love? It's not that your life is over, just that it's going to be a different sort of life."
"New York?" said Mum.
"Oh, my God, I'd love that," I said, pulling a piece of toast from the rack. "I could find you a nice hotel and we could do all the sights."
"You would?"
"Perhaps we can meet that millionaire fella you work for," said Dad. "He can give us a few tips, right?"
I'd never actually told them about my change in circumstances. I kept eating my toast, my face blank.
"Us? Go to New York?" said Mum.
Dad reached for a box of tissues and handed them to her.
"Well, why not? We have savings. You can't take it with you. The old man knew that, at least. Don't be expecting any expensive bequests, eh, Louisa? I'm frightened to pass the bookie in case he jumps out and says Grandad owes him a fiver."
Mum straightened up, her cloth in her hand. She looked to one side.
"You and me and Dad in New York City? Well, wouldn't that be a thing?
We could look up flights this evening if you like." I wondered briefly if I could persuade Margot to say her surname was Gopnik. Mum put a hand to her cheek.
"Oh, gracious, listen to me. Making plans and Grandad not cold in his grave yet. What would he think?"
"He'd think it was wonderful. Grandad would love the thought of you and Dad coming to America."
"You really think so?"
"I know so." I reached across and hugged her. "He travelled the world in the Navy, didn't he? And I also know he'd like to think of you starting back at the Adult Education Centre. No point wasting all that knowledge you've gained over the past year."
"Though I'm also pretty sure he'd like to think you were still leaving me some dinner in the oven before you went," said Dad.
"Come on, Mum. Just get through today, and then we can start planning. You did everything you could for him, and I know Grandad would feel you deserved the next stage of your life to be an adventure."
"An adventure?" Mum mused. She took a tissue from Dad and dabbed at the corner of her eye. "How did I raise a daughter with so much wisdom, eh?" Dad raised his eyebrows, and with a deft move slid the toast off my plate.
"Ah, well, that would be the fatherly influence, you see."
He yelped as Mum flicked a tea towel at the back of his head, and then, as she turned, he smiled at me with a look of utter relief. The funeral passed, as funerals do, with varying degrees of sadness. Some tears, and a sizable percentage of the congregation, wishing they knew the tunes to the hymns. It was not an excessive gathering, as the priest put it politely. Grandad had ventured out so rarely by the end that few of his friends even seemed to know that he'd passed, even though Mum had put a notice in the Stortford Observer. Either that, or most of them were dead too. With a couple of the mourners, it was quite hard to tell the difference. At the graveside, I stood beside Trina, my jaw tense, and felt a particular kind of sibling gratitude when her hand crept into mine and squeezed it. I looked behind me to where Eddie was holding Tom's hand, and he was kicking quietly at a daisy in the grass, perhaps trying not to cry, or perhaps thinking about Transformers, or the half-eaten biscuit he'd wedged into the upholstery of the funeral car. I heard the priest murmur the familiar recitation about dust and ashes, and my eyes filled with tears. I wiped them away with a handkerchief. And then I looked up, and across the grave, at the back of the small throng of mourners, stood Sam. My heart lurched. I felt a hot flush somewhere between fear and nausea. I caught his eye briefly through the crowd, blinked hard, and looked away. When I looked back, he had gone.
I was at the buffet at the pub when I turned to find him beside me. I had never seen him in a suit, and the sight of him looking both so handsome and so unfamiliar briefly knocked my breath from my chest. I decided to handle the situation in as mature a way as possible, and simply refused to acknowledge his presence, peering intently instead at the plates of sandwiches, in the manner of someone who had only recently been introduced to the concept of food. He stood there, perhaps waiting for me to look up, and then said softly, "Sorry about your granddad. I know what a close family you are." Not that close, clearly, or I would have been here. I busied myself arranging the napkins on the table, even though Mum had paid for waiting staff. Yeah, well, life doesn't always work like that. So I've gathered. I closed my eyes briefly, trying to remove the spike from my voice. I took a breath, then finally looked up at him, my face arranged carefully into something neutral. "So how are you?" "Not bad, thanks. You?" "Oh, fine." We stood for a moment. "How's your house?"
"Coming on. Moving in next month."
"Wow!" I was briefly startled from my discomfort. It seemed improbable to me that someone I knew could build a house from nothing. I had seen it when it was just a patch of concrete on the ground. And yet he had done it. That's amazing.
"I know. I'll miss the old railway carriage, though. I quite liked being in there. Life was simple."
We looked at each other, then away. "How's Katie?"
The faintest of pauses. "She's fine."
My mother appeared at my shoulder with a tray of sausage rolls. "Lou, sweetheart, would you see where Trine is? She was going to hand these round for me." "Oh, no, there she is. Perhaps you could take them to her. There's people over there who haven't had anything to eat yet." She suddenly grasped who I was talking to. She snatched the tray away from me. "Sorry, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt." "You weren't," I said, slightly more emphatically than I'd intended. I took hold of the tray's edge. "I'll do it, love," she said, pulling it towards her waist. "I can do it." I held tight, my knuckles glowing white. "Lou, let go," she said firmly. Her eyes burnt into mine. I finally relinquished my grip and she hurried away. Sam and I stood by the table. We smiled awkwardly at each other, but the smiles fell away too quickly. I picked up a plate and put a carrot stick on it. I wasn't sure I could eat anything, but it seemed odd to stand there with an empty plate.
"So, are you back for long?"
"Just a week."
"How's life treating you over there?"
"It's been interesting. I got the sack.
Lily told me. I see a fair bit of her now with the whole Jake thing."
"Yeah, that was surprising." I wondered briefly what Lily had told him about her visit.
"Not to me. I could see it from the first time they met. You know, she's great. They're happy."
I nodded, as if in agreement.
"She talks a lot. About your amazing boyfriend, and how you picked yourself up after the firing thing, and found another place to live, and your job at the vintage clothes emporium."
He was apparently as fascinated as I was by the cheese straws.
"You got it all sorted, then. She's in awe of you."
"I doubt that."
"She said New York suits you." He shrugged. "But I guess we both knew that."
I snuck a look at him while his gaze was elsewhere, marvelling with the small part of me that wasn't actually dying, that two people who were once so comfortable with each other could now barely work out how to string a sentence together in conversation. "I have something for you. In my room at home," I said abruptly. I wasn't entirely sure where it came from. "I brought it back last time, but, you know."
"Something for me?"
"Not you, exactly. It's a Knicks baseball cap. I bought it a while back. That thing you told me about your sister? She never made it to 30 Rock, but I thought, well, maybe Jake might like it." He stared at me. It was my turn to look down at my feet. "That's probably a stupid idea, though," I said. "I can give it to someone else. It's not like I can't find a home for a Knicks cap in New York. And it might be a bit weird, me giving you stuff."
"No, no, he'd love it. That's very kind of you."
Someone beeped a horn outside, and Sam glanced towards the window. I wondered idly if Katie was waiting in the car for him. I didn't know what to say. There didn't seem to be a right answer to any of it. I tried to fight the lump that had risen to my throat. I thought back to the Strega ball. I'd assumed that Sam would hate it, that he wouldn't have a suit. Why did I think that? The one he was wearing today looked like it had been made for him. I'll send it. Do you know what? I said when I couldn't bear it any longer. I think I'd better help Mum with those, with the... There are sausages that... Sam took a step backwards. Sure. I just wanted to pay my respects. I'll leave you to it. He turned away and my face crumpled. I was glad I was at a wake, where nobody would think this particular expression worthy of attention. And then, before I could straighten my face, he turned back to me. Lou, he said quietly. I couldn't speak. I just shook my head. And then I watched him as he made his way through the mourners and out through the pub door. That evening, Mum handed me a small parcel. Is this from Grandad? I said. Don't be daft, she said. Grandad never gave anyone a present for the last 10 years of his life. This is from your man, Sam. Seeing him today reminded me. You left it here the last time you came? I wasn't sure what you wanted me to do with it. I held the little box and had a sudden memory of our argument at the kitchen table. Happy Christmas, he'd said, and dropped it there as he left. Mum turned away and began washing up. I opened it carefully, peeling off the layers of wrapping paper with exaggerated care, like someone opening an artifact from a previous age. Inside the little box lay an enamel pin in the shape of an ambulance, perhaps from the 1950s. Its red cross was made of tiny jewels that might have been rubies, or might have been paste. Either way, it glittered in my hand. A tiny note was folded in the roof of the box. To remind you of me while we're apart. All my love, your ambulance Sam. Kiss, kiss, kiss. I held it in the palm of my hand, and Mum came to look over my shoulder. It's rare that my mother chooses not to speak. But this time she squeezed my shoulder, dropped a kiss on the top of my head, and went back to the washing up. Chapter 27. Dear Louisa Clark, my name is Vincent Webber, grandson of Margot Webber, as I know her. But you seem to know her by her maiden name of DeWitt. Your message came as a surprise because my dad doesn't really talk about his mom. To be honest, for years I was led to believe that she wasn't even alive, although I realize now that nobody ever put it in those exact terms. After I got your message, I asked my mom, and she said there had been some big falling out way before I was born. But I've been thinking, and have decided that's really nothing to do with me, and I would love to know some more about her. You seem to hint that she'd been unwell. Can't believe I have another grandma. Please email back, and thank you for your efforts. Vincent Webber, Vinny. He came at the agreed time on a Tuesday afternoon, the first really warm day of May, when the streets were full of abruptly exposed flesh and newly purchased sunglasses. I didn't tell Margot because, A, I knew she'd be furious, and B, I had a strong feeling she would simply go out for a walk until he had left. I opened the front door and there he stood, a tall blonde man with his ear pierced in 7 places, wearing a pair of 1940s-style baggy trousers with a bright scarlet shirt, highly polished brown brogues and a ferile sweater draped around his shoulders. "Are you Louisa?" he said as I stooped to pick up the flailing dog. "Oh, my," I said, looking him slowly up and down. "You two are going to get on like a house on fire." I walked him down the corridor and we whispered a conversation. It took a full 2 minutes of Dean Martin barking and snarling before she called, "Who was at the door, dear? If it's that awful Gopnik woman, you can tell her her piano playing is showy sentimental tripe. And that's from someone who once saw Liberace." She started to cough. Walking backwards, I beckoned him towards the living room. I pushed open the door. "Margot, you have a visitor." She turned, frowning slightly, her hands resting on the arm of her chair, and surveyed him for a full 10 seconds. "I don't know you," she said decisively. "This is Vincent, Margot," I took a breath. "Your grandson." She stared at him. "Hey, Mrs. DeWitt. Grandma." He walked forward and smiled, then stooped and crouched in front of her, and she studied his face. Her expression was so fierce that I thought she was going to shout at him, and then she gave what sounded like a little hiccup. Her mouth dropped open 1/2 inch and her bony old hands closed on his sleeves. "You came," she said. her voice a low croon cracking as it emerged from somewhere deep in her chest.
You came.
She stared at him, her eyes flickering over his features, as if she were already seeing similarities, histories, prompting memories long forgotten.
Oh, but you're so, so like your father.
She reached out a hand and touched the side of his face.
I like to think I have slightly better taste, Vincent said, smiling, and Margot gave a yelp of laughter. Let me look at you. Oh, my goodness. Oh, you're so handsome. But how did you find me? Does your father know about...
She shook her head, as if it were a jumble of questions and her knuckles were white on his sleeves. Then she turned to me, as if she had forgotten I was even there.
Well, I don't know what you're staring at, Louisa. A normal person would have offered this poor man a drink by now. Goodness, some days I have no idea what on earth you're doing here.
Vincent looked startled, but as I turned and walked to the kitchen, I was beaming. Chapter 28
This was it, Josh said, clapping his hands together. He was sure he was going to get the promotion.
Connor Isles hadn't been invited to a dinner. Charmaine Trent, who had recently been brought across from legal, hadn't been invited to a dinner. Scott Mackey, the accounts manager, had been invited to a dinner before he became accounts manager, and he'd said he was pretty sure Josh was a shoo-in.
I mean, I don't want to get too confident, but it's all about the social thing, Louisa, he said, examining his reflection. They only ever promote people if they think they can mix with them socially. It's not what you know, right? I was wondering if I should take up golf. They all play golf, but I haven't played since I was, like, 13. What do you think of this tie?
Great. It was a tie. I didn't really know what to say. They all seemed to be blue anyway. He knotted it with swift, sure strokes.
I called Dad yesterday, and he said the key thing was to look like you're not dependent on it, right? Like I'm ambitious, and I'm totally a company man, but equally, I could move to another firm at any time, because I'd be so much in demand. They have to feel a sense of threat that you might go somewhere else if they don't give you your due. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yes. It was the same conversation we had had 14 times over the past week. I wasn't sure it even required answers on my side. He checked his reflection again, and then, apparently satisfied, walked over to the bed and leant across to run a hand down the back of my hair.
I'll pick you up just before 7, okay? Make sure you've walked that dog so we don't get held up. I don't want to be late.
I'll be ready.
Have a nice day. Hey, it was great what you did with the old lady's family, you know? Really great. You did a good thing.
He kissed me emphatically, already smiling at the thought of the day ahead. And then he was gone. I stayed in his bed in the exact position he had left me, dressed in one of his T-shirts and hugging my knees. I looked at Lily's text message again. Reading and rereading the words. Then I got up, dressed, and let myself out of his apartment. I was still distracted when I took Margot to her morning hospital appointment, leaning my forehead against the taxi window and trying to sound like I understood what she was talking about. I had clicked on refresh 70-odd times, but Lily had not yet sent me a response.
"Just drop me here, dear," said Margot as I helped her out.
I let go of her arm as she reached the double doors and they slid open as if to swallow her. This was our pattern for every appointment. I would stay outside with Dean Martin, she would make her way in slowly, and I would come back in an hour or whenever she chose to call me.
"I don't know what's gotten into you this morning. You're all over the place. Useless."
She stood in the entrance and handed me the lead. "Thanks, Margot."
"Well, it's like travelling with a half-wit. Your brain is clearly somewhere else, and you're no company at all. Why, I've had to speak to you 3 times just to get you to do a thing for me."
"Sorry."
"Well, make sure you devote your full attention to Dean Martin while I'm inside. He gets very distressed when he knows he's being ignored."
She lifted a finger.
"I mean it, young lady. I'll know."
I was halfway to the coffee shop with the outside tables and the friendly waiter when I found I was still holding her handbag. I cursed and ran back up the street. I raced into reception, ignoring the pointed stares of the waiting patients who glared at the dog as if I had brought in a live hand grenade.
"Hi, I need to give a purse, to Margot DeWitt. Can you tell me where I might find her, please?"
I'm her carer. The woman didn't look up from her screen.
You can't call her?
She's in her 80s. She doesn't do cell phones. And if she did, it would be in her purse. Please, she will need this. It's got her pills and her notes and stuff.
She has an appointment today.
11:15, Margot DeWitt. I spelt it out just in case. She went through the list, one extravagantly manicured finger tracing the screen.
Okay, yeah, I got her. Oncology is down there, through the double doors on the left.
I'm sorry, what?
Oncology. Down this main corridor, through the double doors on the left. If she's in with a doctor, you can leave her purse with one of the nurses there. Or just leave a message with them to tell her where you'll be waiting.
I stared at her, waiting for her to tell me she'd made a mistake. Finally, she looked up at me, her face a question, as if waiting to hear why I was still standing, stupefied in front of her. I gathered the appointment card off the desk and turned away. Thank you, I said weakly, and walked Dean Martin out into the sunshine.
Why didn't you tell me?
Margot sat in the taxi, turned mulishly away from me. Dean Martin sat panting on her lap.
Because it's none of your business. You would have told Vincent, and I didn't want him to feel he had to come and see me just because of some stupid cancer.
What's your prognosis?
None of your business.
How do you feel?
Exactly how I felt before you started asking all these questions.
It all made sense now. The pills, the frequent hospital visits, the diminished appetite, the things I had thought were simply evidence of old age, of over-attentive private US medical care, had all been disguising the much deeper fault line. I felt sick. I don't know what to say, Margot. I feel like...
I'm not interested in your feelings.
But...
Don't you dare get all goopy on me now, she snapped. What happened to that English stiff upper lip? Yours made of marshmallow.
Margot,
I'm not discussing it. There is nothing to discuss. If you're going to insist on getting all wishy-washy with me, you could go and stay in someone else's apartment.
When we arrived at the lavery, she was out of the taxi with unusual vigor. By the time I had finished paying the driver, she was already inside the lobby without me. I wanted to talk to Josh about what had happened, but when I texted him, he was flat out, and I could fill him in that evening. Nathan was busy with Mr. Gopnik. Alaria might freak out, or worse, would insist on stopping by all the time, and smothering Margot with her own brand of brusque care and reheated pork casseroles. There was nobody else I could talk to. While Margot had her afternoon nap, I moved quietly into the bathroom, and, under the pretext of cleaning, I opened the cabinet and looked at the shelf of drugs, noting down the names, until I found the confirmation. Morphine. I looked up the other drugs in the cabinet and searched them online, until I got my answers. I felt shaken to the core. I wondered how it must feel to be looking death so squarely in the face. I wondered how long she had left. I realized that I loved the old woman, with her sharp tongue and her sharper mind, like I loved my family. And some tiny part of me, selfishly, wondered what it meant for me. I had been happy in Margot's apartment. It might not have felt permanent, but I thought I might have a year or more there at least. Now I had to face the fact that I was on shifting sands again. I pulled myself together a little by the time the doorbell rang promptly at 7. I answered, and there was Josh, immaculate, not even a hint of 5 o'clock shadow.
How? I said. How do you look like that after a whole day at work?
He leant forward and kissed my cheek.
Electric razor. And I left another suit at the dry cleaners and changed at work. Didn't want to turn up creased.
But surely your boss will be in the same suit he's been in all day.
Maybe. But he's not the one angling for a promotion. You think I look okay? Hello, Josh, dear.
Margot walked past on her way to the kitchen.
Good evening, Mrs. DeWitt. How are you doing today?
I'm still here, dear.
That's about as much as you need to know.
Well, you look wonderful. And you talk a lot of old bobbins.
He grinned and turned back to me.
So what are you wearing, shortcake?
I looked down. This? A short silence.
Those pantyhose.
I glanced at my legs.
Oh, those!
I've had a bit of a day. They're my feel-better tights, my equivalent of a fresh suit from the dry cleaners. I smiled ruefully. If it helps, I only wear them on the most special occasions. He stared at my legs a moment longer, then dragged a hand slowly over his mouth.
Sorry, Louisa, but they're really not appropriate for this evening. My boss and his wife are pretty conservative, and this is a really upscale restaurant, like Michelin-starred.
This dress is Chanel. Mrs. DeWitt lent it to me.
Sure, but the whole effect is just a little bit...
He pulled a face.
Crazy town.
When I didn't move, he reached out his hand and took hold of my upper arms.
Sweetheart, I know you love dressing up, but could we keep it a little straighter, just for my boss? This evening is really important for me.
I looked down at his hands and flushed. I felt suddenly ridiculous. Of course my bumblebee tights were wrong for dinner with a financial CEO. What have I been thinking? Sure, I said, I'll go and change.
You don't mind?
Of course not. He almost deflated with relief.
Great. Can you make it super quick? I really don't want to be late, and the traffic is backed up all the way down 7th. Margot, would it be all right if I used your bathroom?
She nodded wordlessly. I ran into my bedroom and started hauling my way through my belongings. What did one wear to a posh dinner with finance people? Help me, Margot, I said, hearing her behind me. Do I just change my tights? What should I wear?
Exactly. What do you have on? She said.
I turned to her.
But he said it's not suitable.
For who?
Is there a uniform? Why aren't you allowed to be yourself?
Are these people such fools that they can't cope with someone who doesn't dress exactly like them?
Why do you have to pretend to be someone you're so clearly not?
Do you want to be one of those women? I dropped the hanger I was holding.
I don't know.
Margot lifted a hand to her newly set hair. She gave me what my mother would have called an old-fashioned look.
Any man lucky enough to be your date shouldn't give a fig if you came out in a trash bag and galoshes.
But he... Margot sighed and pressed her fingers to her mouth like people do when they have a lot more they'd like to say but won't. A moment passed before she spoke again.
I think at some point, dear, you're going to have to work out who Louisa Clark really is.
She patted my arm, and with that she walked out of the bedroom. I stood, staring at the space where she had been. I looked down at my stripy legs and back up at the clothes on my rail. I thought of Will and the day he had given the tights to me. A moment later, Josh appeared in the doorway, straightening his tie.
You're not him, I thought suddenly.
In fact, you're really nothing like him at all.
So?
He said, smiling. Then his face fell.
I thought you were going to be ready.
I stared at my feet. Actually, I said. Chapter 29. Margot told me I should go away for a few days to clear my head. When I said I wouldn't, she asked me why ever not, and added that I plainly hadn't been thinking straight for a while. I needed to sort myself out. When I admitted that I didn't want to leave her by herself, she told me I was a ridiculous girl and that I didn't know what was good for me. She watched me from the corner of her eye for a while, her bony hand tapping irritably on the arm of her chair, then raised herself heavily and disappeared, returning minutes later with a sidecar so strong that the first sip made my eyes burn. Then she told me to sit my backside down, that my sniffling was getting irritating, and I should watch Wheel of Fortune with her. I did as I was told and tried not to hear Josh's voice, outraged and uncomprehending, echoing in my head.
You're dumping me over a pair of pantyhose?
When the program had finished, she looked at me, tutted loudly, told me this really wouldn't do, and that we would go away together instead.
But you haven't got any money. Goodness, Louisa, it's immensely vulgar to discuss financial matters, she scolded. I'm shocked by the way you young women are brought up to talk about these things.
She told me the name of the hotel on Long Island that she wanted me to call, instructed me to tell them specifically that I was calling on behalf of Margot DeWitt in order to get the preferential family rate. She added that she had been thinking about it, and if it really upset me so much, I could pay for both of us. And there, didn't I feel better now? Which was how I ended up paying for me, Margot, and Dean Martin to go on a trip to Montauk. We caught a train out of New York to a small, shingle-clad hotel on the shore that Margot had travelled to every summer for decades until frailty, or finance, had stopped her. As I stood, they welcomed her on the doorstep as if she was, indeed, long-lost family. We picked at a lunch of griddled prawns and salad, and I left her talking to a couple who ran the place while I walked down the path to the wide, windswept beach, breathed the ozone-infused air, and watched Dean Martin skittering happily around in the sand dunes. There I started to feel, under the giant sky, for the first time in months, as if my thoughts were not infinitely cluttered by everyone else's needs and expectations. Margot, exhausted by the train journey, spent much of the rest of the next 2 days in the little drawing room, watching the sea or chatting with the elderly patriarch of the hotel, a weather-beaten East Island statue of a man called Charlie, who nodded along to her uninterrupted flow of conversation, and shook his head and said that no, things weren't what they were, or yes, things were changing fast around there. And the two of them would exhaust this topic over small cups of coffee, then sit satisfied about how awful everything had become, and to have this view confirmed by each other. I realised very quickly that my role had simply been to get her here. She barely seemed to need me at all, except to help with fiddly items of clothing and to walk the dog. She smiled more than I had seen her smile for the entire time I'd known her, which was a useful distraction in itself. So, for the next 4 days, I had breakfast in my room, read the books in the little hotel bookshelf, gave in to the slower rhythms of Long Island life, and did as instructed. I walked and walked until I had an appetite again, and could quell the thoughts in my head, with the roar of the waves and the sound of the gulls in the endless laden sky, and the yapping of a small, overexcited dog who couldn't quite believe his luck. On the third afternoon, I sat on my hotel bed, called my mother, and told her the truth about my last few weeks. For once, she didn't talk, but listened, and at the end of it, she said she thought I had been very wise and very brave, and those two affirmations made me cry a little. She put Dad on, and he told me he'd like to kick the arses of those ruddy gopniks. I wasn't to talk to strangers, and to let them know as soon as Margot and I were back in Manhattan. He added that he was proud of me. "Your life. It's never quiet, is it, love?" he said. And I agreed that no, it was not. And I thought back 2 years to my life before Will, when the most exciting thing that happened to me was someone demanding a refund at the Buttered Bun, and realised I quite liked it this way, despite everything. On the last night, Margot and I had supper in the hotel's dining room at her behest. I dressed up in my dark pink velvet top and my three-quarter-length silk culottes, and she wore a frilled green floral shirt and matching slacks. I had sewn an extra button in the waistline so that they didn't slip down over her hips. And we quietly enjoyed the widening eyes of the other guests as we were shown to our seats at the best table by the big window. "Now, dear, it's our last night, so I thought we should push the boat out, don't you?" she said, lifting a regal hand to wave at the guests who were still staring. I was just wondering whose particular boat was being pushed when she added, "I think I'll have the lobster, and perhaps some champagne. I suspect this is the last time I shall come here, after all." I started to protest, but she cut me off. "Oh, for goodness sake! It's a fact, Louisa. A bald fact. I thought you British girls were made of sterner stuff." So we ordered a bottle of champagne and two lobsters, and as the sun set, we picked at the delicious garlicky flesh, and I cracked open the claws that Margot was too frail to manage and handed them back to her. She sucked at them with little delighted noises and passed tiny bits of flesh down to where Dean Martin was being diplomatically ignored by everyone else. We shared a huge bowl of French fries. I ate most of them, and she scattered a few on her plate and said they were really quite good. We sat in companionable, overstuffed silence as the restaurant slowly emptied and she paid with a seldom-used credit card.
"I'll be dead before they come looking for payment. Ha!"
Then Charlie walked over stiffly and put her giant hand on her tiny shoulder. He said he would be getting off to bed, but he hoped he would see her in the morning before she left, and that it had been a true pleasure to see her again after all these years.
The pleasure was all mine, Charlie. Thank you for the most wonderful stay.
Her eyes wrinkled with affection, and they clutched each other's hands until he released hers reluctantly and turned away.
I went to bed with him once, she said as he walked off. Lovely man. No good for me, of course.
As I coughed out my last French fry, she gave me a weary look.
It was the '70s, Louisa. I'd been alone for a long time.
It's been rather nice seeing him again.
Widowed now, of course, she sighed. At my age, everybody is.
We sat in silence for a while, gazing out at the endless inky black ocean. A long way off, you could just make out the tiny winking lights of the fishing vessels. I wondered how it would feel to be out there, on your own, in the middle of nowhere. And then Margot spoke.
I didn't expect to come back here, she said quietly. So I should thank you. It's been something of a tonic.
For me too, Margot. I feel unscrambled. She smiled at me before reaching down to pat Dean Martin. He was stretched out under her chair, snoring quietly.
You did the right thing, you know, with Josh. He wasn't for you.
I didn't respond. There was nothing to say. I had spent 3 days thinking of the person I might have become if I'd stayed with Josh. Affluent, semi-American, mostly happy even. And had discovered that, after a few short weeks, Margot understood me better than I understood myself. I would have moulded myself to fit him. I would have shed the clothes I loved, the things I cared most about. I would have transformed my behaviour, my habits, lost in his charismatic slipstream. I would have become a corporate wife, blaming myself for the bits of me that wouldn't fit, never-endingly grateful for this will in American form. I didn't think about Sam. I'd become very good at that.
You know, she said, when you get to my age, the pile of regrets becomes so huge it can obscure the view terribly.
She kept her eyes fixed on the horizon, and I waited, wondering who she was addressing. 3 weeks passed uneventfully after we returned from Montauk. My life no longer felt as if it had any real certainties at all. So I had decided to live as Will had told me, simply existing in each moment, until my hand was forced again. At some point, I supposed, Margot would either be unwell enough or in debt enough that our contented little bubble would pop, and I would have to book my flight home. Until then, it was not an unpleasant way to live. The routines that punctuated my day gave me pleasure. My runs around Central Park, my strolls with Dean Martin, preparing the evening meal for Margot, even if she didn't eat much, and our now joint nightly viewing of Wheel of Fortune, shouting letters at the mystery wedges. I upped my wardrobe game, embracing my New York self with a series of looks that left Lydia and her sister slack-jawed in admiration. Sometimes I wore things that Margot lent me, and sometimes I wore things I had bought from the Emporium. Every day I stood in front of the mirror in Margot's spare room and surveyed the racks I was allowed to pick from, and a part of me sparked with joy. I had work, of sorts, doing shifts for the girls at the Vintage Clothes Emporium, while Angelica was away doing a sweep of a women's garment factory in Palm Springs that had apparently kept samples of every item it had made since 1952. I manned the till alongside Lydia, helping pale-skinned young girls into vintage prom dresses and praying the zips would hold, while she reorganized the layout of the racks and fretted noisily about the amount of wasted space in their outlet.
"You know what square footage costs now around here?" she said, shaking her head at our lone rotating rail in the far corner. "Seriously, I would be letting that corner as valet parking if we could work out how to get the cars in."
I thanked a customer who had just bought a sequin tulle bolero and slammed the till drawer shut.
"So why don't you let it? To a shop or something? It would give you more income."
"Yeah, we talked about it. It's complicated. As soon as we've got other retailers involved, you need to build a partition and separate access and get insurance, and then you don't know who you got coming in at all hours. Strangers in our stuff? It's too risky."
She chewed her gum and blew a bubble, popping it absently with a purple-nailed finger.
Plus, you know, we don't like anybody.
Louisa! Ashok was standing on the carpet and clapped his glove hands together as I arrived home. You coming to ours next Saturday? Mina wants to know. Is the protest still on? The two previous Saturdays, I couldn't help but notice there had been a distinct dwindling of the numbers. The hopes of local residents were almost non-existent now. The chanting had become half-hearted as the city's budgets tightened, the season protesters slowly drifting away. Months after the action had started, just our little corps remained, Mina rallying everyone with bottles of water and insisting it wasn't over till it was over.
It's still happening. You know my wife.
Then I'd love to. Thank you. Tell her I'll bring dessert.
You got it.
He made a happy mm-mm sound to himself at the prospect of good food and called as I reached the elevator.
Hey!
What?
Nice threads, lady.
That day I was dressed in homage to Desperately Seeking Susan. I wore a purple silk bomber jacket with a rainbow embroidered on the back, leggings, layered vests, and an armful of bangles, which had made a pleasing jangle each time I'd whacked the till drawer shut. It wouldn't close properly unless you did.
You know, he said, shaking his head, I can't believe you used to wear that golf shirt combo when you were working for the Gartnicks. That was so not you.
I hesitated as the lift door opened. I refuse to use the service lift these days.
You know what, Ashok? You're so right.
Out of deference to her status as homeowner, I always knocked before I let myself into Marco's apartment, even though I had had a key for months. There was no response the first time, and I had to check my reflexive panic, telling myself that she often had the radio on loudly, that Ashok would have let me know if anything was wrong. Finally, I let myself in. Dean Martin came skittering up the hallway to greet me, his eyes askew with joy at my arrival. I picked him up and let his wrinkled nose snuffle all over my face.
Yes, hello you. Hello you. Where's your mum, then?
I put him down and he yapped and ran in excited circles.
Margot? Margot, where are you?
She came out of the living room in her Chinese silk dressing gown.
Margot, are you not well?
I dropped my bag and ran to her, but she held up a palm.
Louisa, something miraculous has happened.
My response popped out of my mouth before I had a chance to stop it.
You're getting better.
No, no, no. Come in, come in. Come and meet my son.
She turned before I could speak and disappeared back into the living room. I walked in behind her, and a tall man in a pastel sweater, the beginnings of a belly straining over his belt buckle, rose from a chair and reached across to shake my hand.
This is Frank Jr., my son. Frank, this is my dear friend, Louisa Clark, without whom I could not have made it through the past few months.
I tried to cover my feeling of wrong-footedness.
It was mutual.
I leant over to shake the hand of the woman beside him, who wore a white roll-neck sweater and had the kind of pale candy-floss hair that she might have spent a lifetime trying to control.
I'm Lainey,
she said, and her voice was high, like one of those women who had never been able to let go of girlishness.
Frank's wife. I believe we have you to thank for our little family reunion.
She dabbed at her eyes with an embroidered handkerchief. Her nose was tinged pink as if she had recently been crying. Margot reached out a hand to me.
So it turns out Vincent, the deceitful little wretch, told his father about our meetings and my situation.
Yeah, the deceitful little wretch would indeed be me,
said Vincent, appearing at the door with a tray. He looked relaxed and happy.
Nice to see you again, Louisa.
I nodded, a half-smile now fixed on my face. It was so odd seeing people in the apartment. I was used to the quiet, to it just being me, Margot and Dean Martin. Not Vincent in his checked shirt and Paul Smith tie coming through bearing our dinner tray, and the tall man with his legs concertinaed against the coffee table, and the woman who kept gazing around the living room with slightly startled eyes, as if she had never been anywhere like this before.
They surprised me, you know,
Margot told me, her voice croaking a little, as if she had already talked too much.
He called up to say he was passing, and I thought it was just Vincent, and then the door opened a little wider, and, well, I can't...
You must all think me so shocking. I hadn't even got round to getting dressed, had I? I'd quite forgotten until just now. But we have had the loveliest afternoon. I can't begin to tell you.
Margot reached out her other hand, and her son took it and squeezed it. His chin quivered a little with suppressed emotion.
Oh, really, it has been magical, said Lainey. We have so much to catch up on. I honestly think this was the Lord's work bringing us all together.
Well, him and Facebook, said Vincent. Would you like some coffee, Louisa? There's some left in the pot. I just brought some cookies out in case Margot wanted to eat something.
She won't eat those, I said before I could stop myself.
Oh, she's quite right. I don't eat cookies, Vincent, dear. Those are really for Dean Martin. The chocolate drops aren't actual chocolate. See?
Margot barely drew breath. She seemed completely transformed. It was as if she'd lost a decade overnight. The brittle light behind her eyes had gone, replaced by something soft, and she couldn't stop talking, her tone babbling and merry. I backed towards the door. Well, I don't want to get in the way. I'm sure you all have a lot to discuss. Margot, give me a shout when you need me. I stood, waving my hands uselessly. It's lovely to meet you all. I'm so pleased for you.
We think it would be the right thing if Mom came back with us, said Frank Jr.
There was a brief silence. Came back where? I said.
To Tuckahoe, said Lainey. To our home.
For how long? I said. They looked at each other.
I mean, how long will she be staying, just so I can pack for her?
Frank Jr. was still holding his mother's hand.
Miss Clark, we've lost a lot of time, Mom and I, and we both think it would be a fine thing if we could make the most of what we have. So we need to make arrangements.
The words held a hint of possession, as if he were already telling me of his greater claim over her. I looked at Margot, who looked back at me, clear-eyed and serene.
That's right, she said.
Hold on. You want to leave, I said. And when nobody spoke, here, the apartment. Vincent's expression was sympathetic. He turned to his father.
Why don't we leave for now, Dad? He said. Everyone has a lot to process. We certainly have a lot to work out, and I think Louisa and Grandma need to have a talk, too.
He touched my shoulder lightly as he left. It felt like an apology.
You know, I thought Frank's wife was actually quite pleasant, though not a clue how to dress, poor thing. He had such awful girlfriends when he was younger, according to my mother. She wrote me letters for a while describing them. But a white cotton turtleneck? Can you imagine the horror? A white turtleneck?
The memory of this travesty, or perhaps the speed at which Margot was talking, brought on a bout of coughing. I fetched a glass of water and waited until she recovered. They had left within minutes after Vincent had spoken up. I got the feeling it was done at his urging, and that neither of his parents really wanted to leave Margot. I sat down on the chair.
I don't understand.
This must all seem very sudden to you. It was just the most extraordinary thing, Louisa dear. We talked and talked, and we may even have shed a tear or two. He's just the same. It was like we'd never been apart. He's the same, so serious and quiet, but actually quite gentle, just as he was as a boy. And that wife of his is just the same. But then, out of the blue, they asked me to come and stay with them. I got the distinct feeling they had all discussed it before they came, and I said I would.
She looked up at me.
Oh, come on. You and I know it won't be forever. There is a very nice place 2 miles from their home that I can move to when it all becomes too difficult.
Difficult, I whispered.
Louisa, don't get all sappy on me again, for heaven's sake. When I can't do things for myself. When I'm properly unwell. Honestly, I don't imagine I'll be with my son for more than a few months. I suspect that's why they felt so comfortable asking me.
She let out a dry chuckle. But I don't understand. You said you'd never leave this place. I mean, what about all your things? You can't just go. She gave me a look.
That's exactly what I can do.
She took a breath, her bony old chest lifting painfully underneath the soft fabric.
I'm dying, Louisa. I'm an old woman, and I'm not going to get an awful lot older. And my son, who I thought was lost to me, has been gracious enough to swallow his pain and his pride and reach out. Can you imagine? Can you imagine what it is to have someone do that for you?
I thought of Frank Jr., his eyes on his mother, their chairs pressed together, his hand holding hers tightly.
Why on earth would I choose to stay in this place a moment longer if I can have a chance to spend time with him? To wake up and see him over breakfast and chat about all the things I've missed and see his children. And Vincent, dear Vincent, do you know he has a brother? I have 2 grandchildren. 2! Anyway, I got to say sorry to my son. Do you know how important that was? I got to say sorry. Oh, Louisa, you can hang on to your hurt out of some misplaced sense of pride, or you can just let go and relish whatever precious time you have.
She placed her hands firmly on her knees.
So that's what I plan to do.
But you can't. You can't just go. I had started to cry. I'm not sure where it came from.
Oh, darling girl, I do hope you're not going to fuss about it. Not now. No tears, please. I have a favor to ask.
I wiped my nose.
This is the difficult bit.
She swallowed with some effort.
They won't take Dean Martin. They're very apologetic, but there are allergies or some such. And I was going to tell them not to be ridiculous and that he had to come with me, but to be honest, I've been rather anxious about what will happen to him, you know, after I've gone. He's got years left after all. Certainly a lot longer than I have. So I wondered whether you would take him for me. He seems to like you. Goodness knows why, after how dreadfully you used to cart the poor creature around. The animal must be the very soul of forgiveness.
I stared at her through my tears. You want me to take Dean Martin?
I do.
I looked down at the little dog, who waited expectantly at her feet.
I'm asking you, as my friend, if you would consider it for me.
She was peering at me intently, her pale eyes scanning mine, her lips pursed. My face crumpled. I was glad for her, but I felt heartbroken at the thought of losing her. I didn't want to be on my own again.
Yes. You will?
Of course. And then I started to cry again. Margot sagged with relief.
Oh, I knew you would. I knew it. And I know you'll take care of him.
She smiled, for once not scolding me for my tears, and leant forward, her fingers closing over my hand.
You're that kind of person.
They came 2 weeks later to take her away. I had thought it faintly in decent haste, but I supposed that none of us was quite sure how much time she had left. Frank Jr. had paid off the mountain of management charges, a situation that could be seen as only slightly less altruistic when you realized that this meant he could inherit the apartment rather than it being claimed by Mr. Ovitz. But Margot chose to see it as an act of love, and I had no reason not to do the same. He certainly seemed happy to have her with him again. The couple fussed over her, checking she was okay, that she had all her medication, that she wasn't too tired or too dizzy or feeling unwell or in need of water, until she flapped her hands and rolled her eyes in mock irritation. But she was going through the motions. She had barely stopped talking about him since she had told me. I was to stay and look after the place, for the foreseeable, according to Frank Jr. I think that meant until Margot died, although nobody said it out loud. Apparently, the realtor had said that nobody would want to rent it as it stood, and it was a little unseemly to gut it before the foreseeable. So I had been awarded the role of temporary caretaker. Margot also made the point, several times, that it would help Dean Martin to have some stability while he adjusted to his new situation. I'm not sure Frank Jr. felt that the dog's mental well-being was quite as high on his own list of concerns. She took only 2 suitcases, and wore one of her favourite suits to travel, the jade boucle jacket and skirt with the matching pillbox hat. I dressed it with a midnight blue Saint Laurent scarf, knotted around her narrow neck, to disguise the way it now emerged, painfully bony, from her collar, and dug out the turquoise cabochon earrings as a final touch. I worried that she might be too hot, but she seemed to have grown ever tinier and frailer, and complained of cold weather, even on the warmest of days. I stood on the sidewalk outside, Dean Martin in my arms, watching as her son and Vincent oversaw the packing up of her cases. She checked that they had her jewellery boxes. She planned to give some of the more valuable items to Frank Jr.'s wife, and some to Vincent for when he gets married. And then apparently, satisfied that they were safely stowed, she walked over to me slowly, leaning heavily on her stick.
"Now, dear, I've left you a letter with all my instructions on it. I haven't told the shook I'm going. I don't want any fuss. But I have left a little something for him in the kitchen. I'd be grateful if you could pass it on once we're gone."
I nodded.
"I've written everything you need for Dean Martin in a separate letter. It's very important that you stick to his routine. It's how he likes things."
"You mustn't worry. I'll make sure he's happy."
"And none of those liver treats. He begs for them, but they do make him sick."
"No liver treats." Margot coughed, perhaps with the effort of talking, and waiting for a moment until she could be sure of her breath. She steadied herself on her cane and looked up at the building that had housed her for more than half a century, holding up a frail hand to shield her eyes from the sun. Then she turned stiffly and surveyed Central Park, the view that had been hers for so long. Frank Jr. was calling from the car, stooping so that he could see us more clearly. His wife stood beside the passenger door in her pale blue windbreaker, her hands pressed together with anxiety. She was apparently not a woman who liked the big city.
"Mom?" "One moment, dear. Thank you."
Margot moved so that she stood directly in front of me. She reached out a hand, and as I held him, she stroked the dog's head 3-4 times with her thin, marbled fingers.
"You're a good fellow, aren't you, Dean Martin?"
she said softly.
"A very good fellow."
The dog gazed back at her, rapt.
"You really are the most handsome boy."
Her voice cracked on the last word. The dog licked her palm, and she stepped forward and kissed his wrinkled forehead, her eyes closing and her lips pressed to him just a moment too long, so that his wonky eyes bulged and his paws paddled against her. Her face sagged momentarily.
I could bring him to see you."
She kept her face to his, her eyes shut, oblivious to the noise and the traffic and the people around her.
"Did you hear what I said, Margot? I mean, once you're settled, we could get the train out and..."
She straightened up and opened her eyes, glancing down for a moment.
"No, thank you."
Before I could say anything else, she turned away.
"Now, take him for a walk, please, dear. I don't want him to see me go."
Her son had climbed out of the car and stood on the sidewalk waiting. He offered her a hand, but she waved him away. I thought I saw her blink back tears, but it was hard to tell, as my own eyes seemed to be streaming.
"Thank you, Margot," I called.
"For everything." She shook her head, her lips set.
"Now go, please, dear."
She turned towards the car just as her son approached, his hand outstretched towards her. And I don't know what she did next, because I put Dean Martin on the sidewalk, as she had told me, and walked briskly towards Central Park, my head down, ignoring the stares of the curious people, wondering why a girl in glittery hot pants and a purple silk bomber jacket was crying openly at 11 o'clock in the morning. I walked for as long as Dean Martin's little legs could stand, and then when he stopped, mutinously, near the azalea pond, his tiny pink tongue hanging out and one eye drooping slightly, I picked him up and carried him, my eyes swollen with tears, my chest one breath away from another racking sob. I had never really been an animal person, but I suddenly understood what comfort could be gained from burying your face in the soft pelt of another creature, the consolation of the many small tasks that you're obliged to perform for its welfare.
"Mrs. DeWitt off on vacation?"
Ashok was behind his desk as I entered, my head down and my blue plastic sunglasses on. I didn't have the energy to tell him just yet.
Yup. She never told me to cancel her papers. I better get on it.
He shook his head, reaching for a ledger.
Know when she's coming home?
Let me get back to you. I walked upstairs slowly, the little dog not moving in my arms, as if he were afraid that if he did, he might be asked to use his legs again. And then I let myself into the apartment. It was dead silent, already shot through with her absence, in a way it had never been when she was in the hospital. Dust motes settling in the still, warm air. In a matter of months, I thought, somebody else would live here, ripping out the ancient bathrooms, tearing off the 1960s wallpaper, scrapping the smoked glass furniture, and installing underfloor heating and expensive sound systems. It would be gutted, redesigned, a bolt hole for busy executives or a terrifyingly wealthy family with small children. The thought of it made me feel hollow inside. I gave Dean Martin some water and a handful of kibble as a treat, then made my way slowly through the apartment, with its clothes and its hats and its walls of memories, and told myself not to think about the sad things, but about the delight on the old woman's face at the prospect of living out her days with her only child. It was a joy that had been transformative, lifting her tired features and making her eyes shine. It made me wonder how much all of this stuff, all this memorabilia, had been her way of insulating herself from the lengthy pain of his absence. Margot DeWitt, style queen, fashion editor extraordinaire, woman ahead of her time, had built a wall, a lovely, gaudy, multicoloured wall. To tell herself it had all been for something, and the moment he had returned to her, she had demolished it without a backward glance. Sometime later, when my tears had slowed to intermittent hiccups, I picked the first envelope off the table and opened it. It was written in Margot's beautiful looping script, a remnant of an age when children were judged by their penmanship. As promised, it contained details of the little dog's preferred diet, times of eating, veterinary needs, vaccinations, flea prevention, and worming schedules. It told me where to find his various winter coats. There were different ones for rain, wind, and snow, and his favourite brand of shampoo. He would also require his teeth descaling, his ears cleaning, and, I winced, his anal glands emptying. "She didn't tell me that when she asked me to take you on," I said to him, and he lifted his head, groaned, and lowered it again. Further on, she gave details of where any post should be forwarded. The contact details for the packing company, the items they were not to take, were to remain in her bedroom, and I should write a note and pin it to the door and tell them not to enter. All the furniture, the lamps, the curtains could go. Her son's and daughter-in-law's cards were in the envelope, should I wish to reach them for further clarification. And now to the important things. Louisa, I didn't thank you in person for finding Vincent. The act of civil disobedience that has brought me so much unexpected happiness. But I'd like to thank you now. And for looking after Dean Martin. There are few people I would trust to do as I ask, and love him as I do. But you are one of them. Louisa, you are a treasure. You were always too discreet to tell me the details. But do not let whatever happened with that foolish family next door dim your light. You are a courageous, gorgeous, tremendously kind little creature, and I shall be forever grateful that their loss has been my gain. Thank you. It is in the spirit of thanks that I'd like to offer you my wardrobe. To anyone else, except perhaps your rather mercenary friends at that disgusting clothing store, this would be junk. I am well aware of that. But you see my clothes for what they are. Do with them what you want. Keep some, sell some, whatever. But I know you will take pleasure in them. Here are my thoughts, though I'm well aware nobody really wants the thoughts of an old woman. Set up your own agency. Hire them out or sell them. Those girls seem to think there was money in it. Well, it strikes me that this would be the perfect career for you. There should be enough there for you to start some sort of enterprise. Though, of course, you may have other ideas for your future, far better ones.
Will you let me know what you decide?
Anyway, dear roommate, I will look forward to receiving news. Please kiss that little dog for me. I miss him so terribly already. With fondest regards, Margot.
I put down the letter and sat motionless in the kitchen for a while, then walked through to Margot's bedroom and the dressing room beyond it, surveying the bulging racks, outfit after outfit. A clothes agency? I knew nothing about business, nothing about premises or accounts or dealing with the public. I was in a city whose rules I didn't entirely understand, with no permanent address, and I had failed in pretty much every job I had ever held. Why on earth would Margot believe that I could set up a whole new enterprise? I ran my fingers down a midnight blue velvet sleeve, then pulled out the garment. Holston, a jumpsuit slashed almost to the waist with a mesh insert. I put it back carefully and took out a dress. White broderie anglaise, its skirts and massive ruffles. I walked along that first rail, stunned, daunted. I had only just begun to absorb the responsibility of owning a dog. What was I supposed to do with three rooms full of clothes? That night I sat in Margot's apartment and turned on Wheel of Fortune. I ate the remains of a chicken I had roasted for her last dinner. I suspect she had sneaked most of hers under the table to the dog. I didn't hear what Vanna White said or shout out letters at the mystery wedges. I thought about what Margot had said to me and wondered about the person she had seen. Who was Louisa Clark, anyway? I was a daughter, a sister, a kind of surrogate mother for a time. I was a woman who cared for others, but who seemed to have little idea, even now, how to care for herself. As the glittering wheels spun in front of me, I tried to think about what I really wanted, rather than what everyone else seemed to want for me. I thought about what Will had really been telling me, not to live some vicarious idea of a full life, but to live my own dream. The problem was, I don't think I'd ever really worked out what that dream was. I thought of Agnes across the corridor, a woman trying to convince everyone that she could shoehorn herself into a new life, while some fundamental part of her refused to stop mourning the role she had left behind. I thought of my sister, her newfound contentment once she had taken the step of understanding who she really was. The way she had stepped so easily into love once she allowed herself to do so. I thought of my mother, a woman so moulded by looking after other people that she no longer knew what to do when she was freed. I thought of the three men I had loved, how each of them had changed me, or tried to. Will had left himself indubitably printed on me. I had seen everything through the prism of what he had wanted for me. I would have changed for you too, Will.